This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is at work on assignment this week. Coming up, solitary confinement, another arena in which the U.S. is number one. More revelations on U.S. aggressions against Haiti. And Chakwe Lumumba is no longer with us, but his work continues in Jackson, Mississippi. But first, the U.S. Senate last week rejected President Obama's nomination of NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyer Debo Adigbele for chief of the U.S. Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. The Fraternal Order of Police led the charge against him, saying the fund had tainted itself and its lawyers by representing political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal in a court case. We spoke with Lynn Washington, a veteran reporter in Philadelphia and editor of the influential website ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. Washington has followed Abu-Jamal's case ever since he was charged with killing a Philadelphia policeman in 1981. We asked Washington what the rejection of Adigbele's nomination says about the U.S. Senate.
Well, it says that hypocrisy is writ large. First of all, the characterizations of the nominee were absolutely inaccurate. He did not play a pivotal role in that case. He's been variously accused of being the one that had the Abu-Jamal's death sentence overturned. He's been accused of orchestrating an effort to undermine respect for police officers. The reality is this. The issue that got Abu-Jamal off of death row, the errors made by the trial judge, the bigoted trial judge, Albert Szabo, when he instructed the jury on how to deliberate on the death penalty, that happened in 2001, in December 2001, when a federal district court judge found merit in that claim. Mr. Adigbele started with the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund as a voting rights expert, not criminal law, but civil law, a voting rights expert in 2001. So how he started at the organization around the same time that a federal judge was setting the thing aside, the death penalty aside, how was he responsible for the death penalty being overturned? That is just factually inaccurate. And the flaw here is that both supporters and opponents of this nomination in the Senate did not do their homework, and that's inexcusable. I mean, these people have staffs, and if the staffs are not working, then they are taking money from the public's coffers without doing their job, and there needs to be mass firings on Capitol Hill.
The Republican leader, Senator Mitch McConnell, says he recognizes that a defendant does have the right to counsel of his choice, but he says that the Senate is not required not to hold it against the lawyer for taking the case.
That is absolutely preposterous. It's factually incorrect, and it's ethically repugnant. Here's a gentleman who apparently was okay to get a job on Capitol Hill with the Senate's Judiciary Committee, and now because of his guilt by association, because the LDF didn't come into this case officially until 2011, January 2011, so they would hold this small thing against him, and it also evidences a double standard. As news reports have stated, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, a staunch conservative named John Roberts, provided pro bono legal assistance to a serial killer in Florida. And as someone else has noted, that one of the presidents of the United States, John Adams, represented British soldiers who were charged with murder up in Boston around the time that the Revolution broke out.
We're talking about the Boston Massacre in which Crispus Attucks was killed.
Absolutely. And John Adams, according to history, said, listen, I find this repugnant, but my job as a lawyer to give representation. Lawyers have an ethical duty and a duty under professional standards codes to represent people. This is just wrong. It's just flat wrong what's going on. But this is the way the United States has been moving. And let's also understand, this is not unusual. I mean, these are people, when I say the Senate, I mean, we had senators back decades ago who stood up and fought against having a federal law to end lynching. They thought that extrajudicial killing, extrajudicial murder, was okay. So that body doesn't engender any kind of respect. And this particular incident that just happened, again, underlines in bold how out of touch these people are with the laws that they claim to uphold and extol.
So the U.S. Senate undermining the rule of law is nothing new.
Nothing new at all. And contextually, it's kind of interesting because right now, senators are frothing at the mouth for action to be taken against Russia for its violation of the rules of law in the Ukraine. Russia can't do that. But here they are taking steps to undermine the rule of law. Listen, the Pennsylvania senator, Tea Party Republican, Pat Toomey, pops off by saying, yes, and a defendant has an absolute right to have competent counsel at trial. Yes, a defendant has absolute right to have counsel on appeal, but that's not the case here. Well, excuse me, why is this defendant not entitled to the legal protections that are embedded in the U.S. Constitution, that are embedded in the Pennsylvania State Constitution, and the protections that you said all defendants have an absolute right for? The hypocrisy is just, I mean, you can smell a stench hundreds of miles from Washington, D.C., and I live 130 miles from Washington, D.C., and I can smell a stink up here, even inside the house, with the windows not open.
And what kind of chilling effect does this have on those lawyers who would hope to, well, have long and prosperous careers?
Well, it clearly sends a chilling message in terms of who can be represented. Let's understand that the American system has historically made people pariahs and thus have undermined the rule of law. I think back to the McCarthy era and the pre-McCarthy era when people were just tarred with this label of being a communist. I remember interviewing years ago a former congressman who was a former judge in Detroit, and he was saying that when he was a lawyer, he was selected to represent a group of communists who were being criminally prosecuted by the U.S. government. So he and other counsel who were working on this case, after the trial was over and the persons were convicted, I mean, they were going to be convicted anyway, they just went through a show trial, like we blame on North Korea and China, the lawyers were put in jail by the judge on contempt because the judge ruled that their collective defense was a conspiracy to undermine the administration of justice. So this man who subsequently became a judge and a U.S. congressman, George Crockett, spent 4 months in federal prison for doing his job as a lawyer. Oh, and by the way, he was a black guy.
This magazine is in no way a cheerleader for President Obama. However, he does seem to have behaved with more integrity than Bill Clinton 20 years ago in his nomination of Lonnie Guinier to be the civil rights chief. As soon as there was opposition in the Senate, Bill Clinton withdrew that nomination. President Obama, however, did see this nomination of Mr. Adegbile through to a vote.
Yes, and there's much, very much to point out about the flaws of Obama. And you and your partners have done an excellent job in doing that. So, yes, Obama gave more support to this nominee than he has with others. But you have to at least question the efficacy of what they were doing. The false information that Obama rightly said in the wake of the Senate vote was smeared on his candidate, they made, at least I didn't see, any effort to put the timeline right. There seemed to be, there was a narrative out there, this guy's a bad guy, he lent his support to Abu Jamal, when in fact that was not true. And the problem in America, not only with politicians and the press, is that a narrative comes out, irrespective of how utterly inaccurate that is, that narrative becomes the basis for which people on the left and the right and those in the center who spin around on their heads use as the basis for whatever they do, instead of stepping back and saying, hey, wait a minute, we need to correct this record. So again, it just makes a farce of what we extol as democracy, and we spend billions of dollars going around the world with high-tech weapons, smashing people up to try to get them to go along with our democracy, which really, as Malcolm X said, democracy is nothing but disguised hypocrisy or something to that effect. I hope I didn't mischaracterize what Malcolm said.
And, of course, this nomination failed because Democrats also voted against it.
Yes, spineless Democrats. One of the Democrats that voted against this was Pennsylvania senior Senator Bob Casey. He professes to be a liberal Democrat. And he said that his reason for voting against the nominee was because the killing in 1981 of Daniel Faulkner has left an open wound for his widow, who's been used by the FOP, you know, shamelessly and enthusiastically by her, but it also left an open wound for the people of Philadelphia. Now, who is he talking about? Philadelphia is a majority-minority city. Minorities make up a little less than 60% of Philadelphia's population, and those are the very people who are targeted by police abuse. And Casey says nothing about that. Currently, there is a request from the Pennsylvania chapter of the National Action Network to have a federal probe into police brutality in Philadelphia. I called Casey's office a couple days ago and asked them his position on that, and they would not get back to me. They disconnected their phone numbers and shut down their email account.
Mumia Abu-Jamal was a journalist at the time of this killing. You knew him. What were your impressions of him as a reporter?
He was an excellent reporter, very conscientious. I remember an incident in July of 1978. There was a police killing, and in those days, it was basically a police killing per week. It was involving a guy named Winston Hood. He was a black Muslim street vendor. There was a fight at a bar in a black neighborhood. Him and his partner tried to break the fight up. The police came, saw them in their, you know, Food of Islam uniforms and immediately saw them as the culprits. There was a scuffle. Hood was handcuffed. A policeman ran up after jumping out of his car, ran over to him and shot him in the stomach. So the next day, Abu-Jamal and I are out there covering it, and I see him with his microphone up in the air. And I'm like, in my mind, you know, the next radio guy, there's nobody in front of you. What are you doing? And he was saying that he was getting ambient sound for his report. So from my vantage, and having known Mr. Abu-Jamal since probably about 1972, I see him as an excellent reporter. And when you look at the body of work that he's been able to do in prison, 30 years of which were in death row isolation, 7 books, over 3,000 commentaries, it's amazing. And part of the pushback that you get to Abu-Jamal from members of the media, I think, are predicated on pure jealousy for a person that has been able to do so much with so little. I mean, this guy knows more about what's going on in the world than 95% of the journalists out here, and he doesn't even have access to the Internet, reading books and watching TV. So he's an extraordinary individual, and that's in part what creates the ire in certain people against this guy. I mean, you know, he didn't like Paul Robeson, he didn't like Malcolm X, he didn't like W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, what's new?
Lynn Washington is a professor of journalism at Temple University in Philadelphia. The family of the late Chukwe Lumumba had to raise funds to pay for an independent autopsy to determine the actual cause of death of the late Jackson, Mississippi mayor. The state coroner refused to perform an autopsy to back up the claim that Lumumba died from natural causes. Some of Lumumba's supporters, including an elected Hinds County supervisor, believe he was assassinated. We asked one of Lumumba's close confidants in the Malcolm X grassroots movement, Akinyele Umoja, the chairman of African American Studies at Georgia State University, if Mississippi's refusal to do an autopsy is unusual.
They probably don't do it on a lot of black people because their lives aren't considered that valuable. And I think to call for an autopsy is like a political question. You know, it's like a question, and we know that Chokwe is an activist, he's a revolutionary, and we know how there's been wrongdoing by the government of the lives and liberty of black revolutionaries historically. I mean, going back to when we first got to this country, even before there was the United States. So Shirley coming out of a tradition, the same tradition of a Marcus Garvey, the same tradition of a Malcolm X, a Martin Luther King. And we believed there was wrongdoing in some of their deaths, right? We want to make sure that we've done everything possible to make sure that there was no wrongdoing in the death of Shokwe Lumumba. We want to be careful. And so as a matter of self-determination, we supported the call of the National Conference of Black Lawyers to have an autopsy in this case. And that's what his family wanted, and that's what his close friends and family and comrades also wanted.
One would think that with this being the state of Mississippi and Shokwe Lumumba's history in the state of Mississippi, that an autopsy would be pro forma.
Right, for an important political official and for the mayor of the most populous city in the capital city, you would think so, yes.
Actually, I meant for a person who has been on the other side of very entrenched forces in Mississippi for decades.
Yeah, but then what you're asking for is for the state that we know has not been sensitive to our interests and our needs to be sensitive to our interests and needs. And so, yeah, demand could have been made for that, but then do we even want to trust them to do that anyway? Would it be better to have somebody that we felt would be independent to do an autopsy so we feel more certain about the results that came up?
In other words, even if the state had done an autopsy, the family would probably want an independent one.
There would still be questions, right? Because it's a matter of how much we trust them.
The Malcolm X grassroots movement is also at the center of a campaign to run Shokwe Lumumba's son, Shokwe Antar Lumumba. The special election is April 8th. There are other people who would like to be candidates who have been candidates for mayor of Jackson, and there is more money to be raised, I assume.
Yes, most definitely. If Shokwe is to run, Shokwe Antar Lumumba is going to run, then we would have to raise money to support his candidacy. Just as we had to do with his father. His father had to do a national tour, and there were a lot of friends from around the country, and as well as in Mississippi, who contributed to that campaign.
Yes, and you're also raising money and organizing for Jackson Rising. That's the conference
right.
That is scheduled and still on for May.
May 2nd and 4th, and it's the continuation of Shokwe's vision. You know, we're hurt and we're shocked by his death, his sudden death. But one of the things that was on the agenda was this Jackson Rising Conference, a new economies conference to promote cooperative economic development, to promote worker management, to promote economic democracy and economic justice, starting in Jackson, but also focusing on other black majority communities in Mississippi. And so we're still encouraging people to come to work on that economic vision that Shokwe Lumumba had and others had to try to move us forward. So that'll be May 2nd through the 4th.
That would be whether there is a Shokwe Antar Lumumba as mayor or a rival mayor.
There were things that we talked about, the Malcolm X grassroots movement talked about, in terms of participatory democracy in Jackson and also in Mississippi, as well as cooperative economic development and economic justice in Mississippi. We're still going forward no matter who's the mayor.
A number of members of the Malcolm X grassroots movement picked up and moved to Jackson once the campaign for Shokwe was underway.
Right.
And I'm assuming that you're not about to leave right yet.
Oh, no. I mean, there were people there who moved long before the campaign. There are people who joined our movement who are local to Mississippi who live there. And no, we're not because Mayor Shokwe died, it's even more reason for us to continue our work there in Mississippi. We need other people to move back there now because we're not backing up on what we've already accomplished and the vision that he and others laid out for us.
Shokwe Lumumba proved that a person with his politics can be elected and overwhelmingly elected in Jackson.
Right. Well, it demonstrates that a person with revolutionary politics, that there's a way we can marry that to the consciousness of our people and we can be elected on a platform that people are clear as a a platform that involves, it's not his platform. I wouldn't necessarily call a revolutionary platform. The slogan was "a people should decide," but it was certainly a democratic, with a small d, a democratic platform that involved a grassroots movement. So they were clear it was a grassroots movement that was pro-self-determination and was pro-economic justice that they were supporting by supporting Chokwe Lumumba. And people thought that was a proper change for them at this time. So we want to continue to build on that legacy.
But we cannot assume that 30-year-old Antar Lumumba shares his father's politics, at least not in totality.
Well, it's similar. Chokwe Antar Lumumba has been, from birth, been a part of the same movement that his father was a part of. When Chokwe, who was also the founder of the New African People's Organization, used to speak, he would say, "I'm speaking on behalf of the men, women, and children of the New African People's Organization." Chokwe Antar Lumumba has been involved. He was a member of our New African Scout Program. He was a New African Panther. They're not the same man, no. I mean, I've known Chokwe Lumumba and been his comrade since 1979, and there are some things we might differ on. But I will say this, he has the same grounding, same socialization, same political outlook as his father, yes.
Professor Akinyele Umoja, a close friend and comrade of the late Chokwe Lumumba. Former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal, the country's best-known political prisoner, has these thoughts on Chokwe Lumumba's passing.
Chokwe Lumumba, presente. His name was Chokwe, Chokwe Lumumba. And for over 40 years, he was a people's lawyer dedicated to the needs of the black nation. As a young lawyer in Detroit, he worked to defend members of the nationalist group, the Republic of New Africa, after their members were attacked by police and many were arrested back in 1981. When he signed on to defend RNA members Bilal Sunni Ali and Fulani Sunni Ali, the judge went out of his way to remove him from the case. But Lumumba and the Alis fought to reverse this order, and sure enough, it got reversed. That fierce determination fueled him through an exemplary career in law, and he developed the nationalist practice that attracted radicals and revolutionaries as clients. When famed rapper Tupac Shakur was charged with aggravated assault on several cops, Lumumba represented him and beat the case. When the Scott sisters were fighting an unjust conviction, Chokwe Lumumba convinced the Mississippi governor, Haley Barbour, to free them in 2011 after over 17 years in prison. When he entered electoral politics, Jackson, Mississippi would become his city after election as mayor. He was able, imaginative, and determined. Chokwe Lumumba, after 66 years of life, recently joined his ancestors. He never stopped fighting for the freedom of black people.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania. Black politicians, for the most part, have shown themselves to be no better than their white counterparts in safeguarding the rights and well-being of African Americans in the nation's cities. However, the late Chokwe Lumumba seemed poised to break that mold. Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
Absolutely nothing underscores the political bankruptcy of our glittering black political class more starkly than its abject failure from the time of the first black big city mayors in the 60s and 70s to the present. From the growth of the Congressional Black Caucus from a handful in 1965 to about 40 at the time of the Katrina disaster and the displacement of half the black population of New Orleans, nothing marks their utter uselessness to black communities more than their failure thus far to come up with any model of urban economic development other than gentrification. The moving of poorer, usually black folks, out of urban neighborhoods to bring richer, often whiter residents, upscale shopping, trendy business, and tourism in. We can't even come close to blaming this on evil, immoral Republicans. Everywhere we look, Black Democrats and their appointees have been the prime movers and shakers in displacing the black communities, which provided the very constituencies that voted in black mayors and legislators into office. You can look at Brooklyn or Columbus. You can look at Atlanta or Chicago. You can look at Tampa or Philly or New Orleans. In each and every case, black public officials took it upon themselves to sell the dismantling of public housing and the raising of entire communities as a process to which there was no alternative. But in Jackson, Mississippi last year, longtime radical black activists around Chokwe Lumumba succeeded in winning the mayor's seat. Lumumba died just 8 months into his 4-year term as mayor and will be laid to rest this Saturday. But even before his election, with the negative examples of places like Atlanta before them, the circle around Mayor Lumumba began thinking through not how to govern Jackson, Mississippi, but how to transform it. It's no secret that there were multiple factions inside the administration of Mayor Lumumba. Some of them wanted to make permanent peace and assimilate into the black contingent of Mississippi's Democratic Party, alongside Congressman Bernie Thompson, the ranking Democrat on the House Homeland Security Committee. But others around Mayor Lumumba wanted not to govern Jackson as it is, and as the black misleadership class does everywhere else, they insisted and still insist on transforming it. They want to do what the black misleadership class won't do, come up with a model of urban development that is not gentrification, an economic development model that develops poor areas for the people who live there now, not for some class of urban pioneers and tourists you might attract later. This conflict will play out on several levels. A special mayoral election will take place within a few weeks to fill the unexpired term of Mayor Lumumba. Most of the candidates jockeying for office are undoubtedly intent on governing Jackson, not transforming it. There may be one exception, however, but this is not yet clear. What is clear is that the first weekend in May, Jackson will host a Jackson Rising, an economic conference on how to transform a working city for the benefit of those who live there now, a conference on what people's economic development can and ought to look like. These are important questions, vital questions, questions for which our glittering class of black politicians and placeholders across this vast country have no answer, and so will never ask. Black Agenda Report will certainly be there, and the eyes of Black America will be watching carefully.
Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon. People's lawyer Lynn Stewart has been out of prison since the beginning of this year on compassionate release after spending 4 years behind bars for the crime of zealously defending her client, accused in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Stewart is suffering from stage 4 breast cancer. However, her husband and comrade, Ralph Pointer, says Stewart has been unable to access conventional medical care since her release because of a snafu in her Medicaid and Medicare coverage.
The rules regarding both of those are such that it best described as a bureaucratic morass. Lynn getting out of prison in Texas, the period for her to sign up happened while she was in prison, which she had no idea of what was going on, had no ability to communicate. So therefore, they penalized her because while she was in prison, they continued paying her insurance on the insurance, Oxford, for 2 years, and then we said, okay, she had no way of knowing that they were paying Oxford, but we'll pay that. But you can't pay it until 6 months later. The sign-up period is in July. And then she has a notification that she is being fined for not having coverage during that period. But the long and the short of it is, she still does not comply with all of the regulations necessary for her to get medical care. So now we're going on to the 3rd month since she's been out of prison, no medical care. but we have been doing all the homeopathic things to beat this cancer. But you understand what has happened here with the so-called Affordable Care Act. You can't access it. The computers are wrong, and if it's not one thing, it's another. As we speak, we were on our way to Medicare to see if she could get a commitment. And Sloan Kettering asked that there's a letter of commitment from the Medicare that Lynn is in the process. We can't get that letter. Even though we bought 6 months of insurance to the carriers to the period where she can sign up in July.
So Lynn was let out of prison based upon compassionate release because she has a terminal disease and she has not been able to access medical care.
They needed a letter of commitment that Lynn had signed up. We can't get the letter, although we have signed up and paid for the insurance up to the period where she can sign on, which is in July.
So here we have Lynn Stewart, who was released from prison, a compassionate release, because she has a terminal disease, and yet she's not been able to avail herself of conventional medical care.
There you go. There it is. And so one of the things I had said to Lynn early on, before she was sentenced, one of the worst things that could happen to you is you become the Mumia exception. You know, Mumia, the law is one thing, but when it comes to him, there's an exception. I says, I don't want to see the Lynn Stewart exception. Well, we seem to have had the Lynn Stewart exception over and over again. Law does not apply to those people who are politically active. And so it's an outrageous situation, but that's the reality of it.
So, have you been trying to get the powers that be to intercede on Lynn's behalf to make that compassionate release and the underlying intention of it real?
Yes, we have gotten at this link with institutions that are designed to help people gain access to health care. And we have left no stone unturned. And as I was saying, we were going back to care today to see if we could nudge somebody in the office to give us a letter saying that Lynn had filed so that we could show that to Sloan Kettering and that they could act on that if they have a letter of intention to cover Lynn from the medical organizations. But we are not able to do that to date. And so it's the most amazing situation, but I say, welcome to America.
That was Ralph Pointer speaking from New York. On any given day, 80,000 men and women and many juveniles are held in solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. That's about equal to the entire prison population of Great Britain, and more than the incarcerated population of the vast bulk of the world's countries. Bonnie Kerness works with the Prison Watch Project of the American Friends Service Committee. She's author of the article, Race and the Politics of Isolation in U.S. Prisons, recently published in the Atlantic Journal of Communication. Kerness thinks the estimate of U.S. prisoners held in solitary is too low.
That figure of 80,000 has been thrown around for years. I don't believe it includes juveniles. I don't believe it includes county facilities. I don't believe it includes immigration facilities, all of which I've gotten complaints from. I think that that number is state and federal. I don't think it's reflective of the range of people. If I say to you, there are 80,000 people in isolation in the states and the feds, you're going to image males of color. And I think it has to do with children of color, immigrant children, and people who are just thrown in county jails. And for whatever reason, I had one white man come in and say that he was put in isolation in a county jail and forced to wear what they call a chin suit. It's clear plastic, and they put them in isolation because they deem them mentally ill.
And you were speaking of detention prisons. That's the largest growing population. It numbers
That's
in
right.
hundreds of thousands.
and most of them are private. I believe that while the Department of Corrections says we place people in isolation for safety and security reasons, and certainly the largest portion of the people in isolation are people in the punishment units that committed an infraction, and that's their punishment. But there are many others that are there for mental health reasons, for certainly this started out in my generation with the activists who found themselves in prison. And if you look up the case of Imam Jamil Al-Amin, my generation, known as Wrap Brown, he's in Florence. New Jersey has one of the first control units in the country. It opened up in 1975 and held what they considered black radicals. They held a prisoner named Ojeri Lutuo there, who was a member of the Black Liberation Army. Well, you put someone in prison in the 1970s, or you put them in isolation, I think he wrote me in 1986, and in 2008, they're still telling him that, you know, he can't be let out of the control unit, he can't be let out of isolation because of his belief in the BLA and his radical positions. Well, he's been in isolation for 22 years. Why not? I guarantee you he hasn't had any contact with the BLA during that period.
You write that prisons are a significant contributor to despair in poor minority communities. That is, prison actually contributes to the underlying causes of crime, the crime that prisons are supposedly built in response to.
Right. Prison is not an answer for anything. Helping people transform themselves, giving them jobs, giving them an appropriate education, we know what works. And the opposition also knows what works for their agenda. They want these kids off the street. They don't want black babies being made that the state may have to take care of. They don't want to supply jobs and education to inner city youngsters. That 15-year-old in Newark is worth nothing on the streets to the United States economy. You put him behind bars, that kid is generating $30,000 a year. And the secretary gets paid, and the architect gets paid, and the plumber gets paid, and the food vendor, and the medical vendor, and that touches on the whole area of privatization and the fact that the 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery. Slavery is abolished except for those who have been convicted of a crime. And who takes a look at that as a core reason for prisons?
Modern mass incarceration dates from around 1970. There's been about an eightfold.
No accident.
That's right. Many of us believe that mass black incarceration is the state response to the black freedom movement of the 60s.
That's right. And I think that the thinking has to be broadened in that, too, because it happened to American Indian Movement children, it happened to Chicanos, you know, it happened to the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. I mean, there was a youth rebellion across the country of many cultures, and they got hit just as hard. No matter where you go in the country, if you go west, you're going to find the prisons full of Aboriginal people. If you go southwest, you're going to find them full of Chicano, Mexican. So, and it's all people of color. And I, you know, I've been around long enough to say, wait a minute, I'm looking at the same thing overseas. You look at Abu Ghraib, look at Bagram, you look at the U.S. prisons overseas. Well, guess who's in them? Guess what color they are, and guess how old they are. It's the same population as here.
Bonnie Kerness of the American Friends Service Committee's Prison Watch Project. Jean Ross, a lawyer and activist with New Jersey's People's Organization for Progress, is a longtime advocate of abolishing prisons as they currently exist in the United States. According to many of her incarcerated clients, the state's most savage lockup is Bayside Prison in the southern part of the state. The guards at Bayside are famous for their violence and open racism. Ross has been told that some inmates would rather be put in solitary confinement than be transferred to Bayside.
In general, there appears to be a level of intimidation that starts during orientation when you first enter the prison, and then that level of intimidation continues through daily life. People in orientation are threatened. They're told, you're not anyplace else now. You're here at Bayside, and you're going to do things the way we want you to do. If you touch one of us, we're going to hurt you badly. If you touch one of our women, we're going to kill you. The explicitness of racial epithets and the expression of racial hatred seems to be much more pervasive. I have never heard anything like what I heard from a prisoner who said that after his cell was searched at one point, he came back to find a noose on his bed. I spoke to prisoners who said that they would not go to meals on the second shift because they did not want to literally walk the halls and be in the sight of officers, because the violence is so unpredictable that people just felt safer staying in their cells. In other prisons, you know, there's a whole disciplinary system. If you do, you know, a variety of things, you can be disciplined and placed in solitary confinement, or you may be beaten if you do something that is felt to be aggressive. At Bayside, people just thought that it's like driving on the turnpike while black. Being a prisoner at Bayside puts you at risk of being assaulted. The second thing is the viciousness of the assaults. What I heard a lot about was officers, plural, would subdue a prisoner, handcuff him with his hands behind his back, and stomp on his face and kick him while he was handcuffed. They would drag people down. People who were handcuffed, they would be dragged down a corridor, thrown down steps. Their heads would be jammed into the walls. One prisoner described to me listening to a 10 to 15 minute beating of a person who was handcuffed in that way. And some of the men who I spoke to said they were crying because they couldn't bear to hear the cries and pleas of their fellow human beings. One person was locked out on a winter day to wash windows in icy weather. Another person was dragged naked on a salted concrete walkway. The department's disciplinary procedures say that you're supposed to, if there's a problem with a prisoner, there's an escalating series of responses. And the most mild of those is called an on-the-spot correction. And it usually means that the correction officer says to the prisoner, you did that, you're not supposed to do that, don't do it again, go back to your cell right now, something like that. What happens apparently at Bayside is on-the-spot correction through punches. Just someone doesn't like what you do, they don't speak to you, they punch you in the face. And I've talked to many witnesses. Another thing that seems to be different at Bayside is the practice of, after there's an incident where a prisoner is beaten, other officers will come back and talk to anyone who might have witnessed that incident and threaten them and intimidate them and beat them. At Bayside, apparently, if you are beaten, you are likely to be taken to the clinic area where there are detention cells right in back of where the clinic is. And the officers do that even though they know that other prisoners can look out of their windows and see this. They're taken down to this area behind the clinic and the beatings continue. And the people who hear this are people, other prisoners who are in the clinic for legitimate reasons. But if the prisoners are hearing these beatings, that means that the medical staff is hearing these beatings. And this brings me to a point of great concern, which is that the nurses and the occasional doctors who are in the clinic area, whatever clinicians are there, must know what's going on. They are asked to patch up these folks who have been beaten. They must know that they have been beaten, that they didn't fall out of their bed. There's no indication at all that these clinicians report either to the prison administration, to the medical director, or the director of health services. So there's kind of complicity of the medical staff.
That was Jean Ross of the People's Organization for Progress in New Jersey. It's been 10 years since the United States backed a coup in Haiti and then drove its democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, into exile in Africa. Now it's been revealed that 6 years later, in 2010, the U.S. and its allies proposed to drive another Haitian president, René Préval, out of office and out of the country. That story has not seen the light of day in most of the U.S. corporate media, according to Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
No, it hasn't. And what you refer to, we know from revelations made by the OAS special rep to Haiti at the time, Ricardo Seitenfuss, this threatened removal of Préval on a plane, as it was put to Préval. This came actually directly from the head of the UN mission down in Haiti, which we know from State Department cables made available by WikiLeaks. The U.S. government sees as a way to manage Haiti on the cheap, essentially. So, you know, we can clearly see the U.S. hand behind this threat as well. The U.S. ambassador to Haiti at the time was in a private meeting of something they call the core group, a secretive group of foreign power brokers in Haiti, and clearly also was, according to Seitenfuss, was in favor of this threat to remove Préval. This is definitely a hugely important story, and it's a real shame that the major media outlets don't seem to be giving it any attention.
So here we have the United States forcing into exile one president of Haiti in 2004, and then 6 years later proposing to do the same thing to another. That's rather high-handed even for a superpower like the United States.
It is, but, you know, it comes out of a long tradition. I mean, you have over 200 years. This year is the 210th anniversary of Haiti's independence. During that whole history, the U.S. has been interfering in Haiti's affairs, along with France, of course, the imperial power that Haiti got its independence from. So this kind of intervention has never really stopped. It's been the U.S., France, and Canada who've continued to muddle on Haiti's affairs, try to control what's happening there, and in particular control the people of Haiti. It's a direct assault on democracy and popular will we've seen expressed over and over again with the elections of Aristide twice by great majorities of people. Of course, Préval, seen, I think, by many with a lot of legitimacy, is not as progressive of a president as Aristide, but he was elected in 2006 when Aristide's Famille-Lavalas party was not allowed on the ballot due to, again, outside foreign intervention. At the time, Famille-Lavalas is essentially seen as an illegal party. It was practically driven underground, persecuted, its leaders imprisoned on bogus charges under the post-coup government that was installed on Haiti by Washington. And so you saw Préval come to office in kind of a surprise to Washington election by, again, a great number of people because, you know, this was the best choice they had without Famille-Lavalas on the ballot. Then again, you see, before his term is over, the same foreign powers threatening to remove him by force. And Préval, according to Seitenfuss, told them that he is not Aristide, he is Salvador Allende. This is a reference to, you know, of course, the coup in Chile, where Allende stayed in the presidential palace to the end, supposedly committed suicide. Préval made clear he wasn't going to be thrown out. Seitenfuss's revelation here is very interesting, too, and he shows that it was really Brazil and Argentina diplomats from those countries that stopped this coup in the making from happening.
Yes, this puts Préval in a somewhat different light, or possibly a heroic light, in that he was marked for expulsion and exile and stood up to the superpower.
It does. There's a couple issues here. I mean, one is he was the popularly elected, democratically elected leader of the country. This is the person the people of Haiti chose. Now, of course, the election, again, it was not really a fair election in that the most popular party in the country, Famille-Lavalas, was not allowed on the ballot. But as imperfect as it was, the Haitian people overwhelmingly chose this person. So it would have been a double assault on democracy and a double indignity for the foreign powers, the U.S. and others, to remove the democratically elected president by force simply because they got tired of him, didn't like what he was doing. We know that also from State Department cables made available by WikiLeaks that the Obama administration had really gotten sick of Préval. And the cables are quite disparaging in how he's described. You know, I think you also see some of the racism come through there, and that, you know, he's referred to in ways that you don't see, you certainly wouldn't see many Western heads of state referred to in the same kind of fashion. So, yeah, it was really a double attack on Haiti's democracy.
But the U.S. and other foreigners did succeed in engineering the election that followed, the one that put Martelly in power.
Yeah, and this is directly related to the same dynamic between the U.S. and Préval, in that it was Préval's, his party's candidate, Jude Celestin, who, according to the official results, was going to be headed into the runoff. You know, Haiti has a runoff election process. If you don't get a certain number of votes in the first round, there isn't a clear winner, you know, overwhelming winner in the first round. It proceeds to a runoff with the two top candidates, not an uncommon electoral system. So, according to the official results, Celestin, Préval's candidate, was headed to the runoff along with Marlon Monegat, who's a conservative former first lady from one of the post-coup regimes after Aristide was ousted the first time. So, again, you know, Lavalas being kept off the ballot, people's will not truly being expressed here, but you had some choice, at least among the political spectrum, left to right, with those two candidates. And what ended up happening was the Organization of American States, led by the United States, France, and Canada, again, you know, your traditional torturers of Haiti, as Noam Chomsky calls them, intervened through the OAS. They sent a special expert mission down there to look at the results of the elections in the first round. We did a statistical analysis of their report, and we found that their conclusions were completely arbitrary. What were their conclusions? Well, they concluded that Celestin should not proceed to the second round, but Michel Martelly should. You know, again, there was no statistical basis for them to make this decision. In fact, one of the American members of this expert commission said as much, but they continued to defend these conclusions. And so that's what ended up happening. You had then two conservative candidates, Martelly and Monegat, go into the runoff, and Martelly ended up being elected by less than 17% of the electorate.
So now here we are, 4 years later. Is there any democratic light on the horizon in Haiti?
Well, there is whenever the people's will can be expressed. You know, unfortunately, at the current moment, Fanny Lavalas is still excluded from elections, as far as we can see. There's not really any indication that they're going to be allowed on the ballot in the upcoming elections. Hopefully they will be. These elections, by the way, have been delayed for something like 2 years now, you know, which is another part of the problem. Even you have the U.S. and the U.N. Publicly calling for these elections, and also mouthpieces in the U.S. media that are very sympathetic to U.S. foreign policy, such as the Washington Post the other day in an editorial calling for the Haitian government to hurry up and have these elections, you know, since they're so overdue. But this is another case where, through processes in Haiti on the ground, whether influenced by foreign powers or not, also democracy is under attack through this kind of delayed electoral process and other problems. And so, you know, the Haitian people continue to be disenfranchised. They haven't had a chance since this OAS, you know, U.S.-led intervention to overturn the elections last time. They haven't had a chance to elect legislators who might challenge the Martelly administration and provide a check on what it's doing. And, you know, by the way, I mean, it might be worth reminding your listeners that, among other things, Martelly has been very sympathetic to the idea of reconstituting the Haitian army. Of course, your listeners will know that the Haitian army historically has been used as a weapon against the Haitian people, and that there's a number of former paramilitaries and former Duvaliers who are very much looking forward and hoping and lobbying and demonstrating for the reconstitution of this Haitian army. Of course, we also know that Martelly himself has admitted to being a former Tonton Macoute. So there's some very disturbing questions about Haiti's future underway, and these are just some of the more blatant examples. I mean, of course, there's all the economic questions that are ongoing and situations that have arisen out of the earthquake where you still have hundreds of thousands of people in IDP camps, hundreds of thousands of other people still displaced, made homeless, a lot of them forcibly evicted. We've seen essentially a policy of forced eviction. These are the people that the world, their hearts went out to so strongly and publicly and so on after the 2010 earthquake. And these are the same people that Martha Lee, through his policies, you know, Haitian police go in and forcibly evict these people, and they're still homeless. So, you know, there's so many important issues underway in Haiti right now. For the Haitian people to be deprived of an opportunity to choose who's going to represent them and handle these big decisions, it's really atrocious.
And Haitian patriots might say that any agreements that the previous governments might have signed with foreign corporations regarding resources should not be in effect, are in fact illegitimate.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's that question too. I mean, to what extent have the Haitian people really had anyone representing them that have made so many of these important decisions in recent years? I mean, before Préval, you know, if you had this interim government that was really a dictatorship imposed on Haiti by Washington, headed by Gerard Latortue, and it carried out a really systematic and brutal killing of thousands of people, imprisonment of many others, blatant political persecution of Fami Lavalas and other popular movements and parties and so on. And so these were the leaders that made some of these decisions at the time. And then you've had the Martha Lee government, certainly not brought to office in any sort of a democratic fashion, continue to make these kinds of deals with different foreign companies and governments and so on. I mean, the Caracol Industrial Park, for example, you know, it's supposed to be the jewel in the crown of this Clinton, Hillary and Bill Clinton-led development plan for Haiti. It's actually a plan that goes back way before the earthquake, and it's basically a model that's been tried in Haiti before and you know, with very limited results. This is kind of the sweatshop model of development where low-paid Haitian workers are basically working without any real rights are supposed to somehow help Haiti economically develop. Well, that's a really problematic idea on its face. But, you know, even worse is that this was tried under Duvalier, and the result was Cité Soleil, the biggest slum in Haiti and what's supposed to be really the most impoverished slum in the Western Hemisphere. This arose out of the situation where these workers weren't able to provide for themselves or their families anymore. The jobs dried up. We're already seeing a similar situation with Caracol, where they have far fewer investors in that project, people that want to source labor there than they had said they would, and far fewer jobs going to Haitians in that park than they had said there would be as well.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.